enthusiasts, this is Tim Ludwig from SafetyDoc.com. Good to have you here. Welcome to the Inspiration for Your Safety Culture podcast, which is simulcast as a blog on SafetyDoc.com. Join us at SafetyDoc.com for 30 years of research, stories, videos, books, and blogs, all to get your safety culture fix. Now let's get to it. Hey there, safety enthusiasts. Tim Ludwig here. I just published a podcast called Are There Gaps in Your Safety Systems? Asking the question if there are latent hazards and complacent risks that are undetectable by our current safety management systems, and talking about a prison escape in upstate New York as a cautionary tale directing us to look at our safety systems with more detail. I thought I'd rebroadcast a podcast by Dan Clark, who interviewed me after a speech I gave on this prison escape. So enjoy and send me any questions that you have. Thank you.
The prison has many different layers of concrete, steel, as well as processes. And in the safety world, we have the same thing. But some of the hazards that are still out there tend to be latent.
A prisoner escapes from prison through a tunnel he took 19 years to dig. How can we learn workplace safety from the movie The Shawshank Redemption? Hi there, I'm Dan Clark. Today we're talking with safety expert Dr. Timothy Ludwig. Tim has over 25 years' experience doing foundational research in safety culture change and is a professor at Appalachian State University. Hello, Dr. Tim.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Gaps in workplace safety systems are like prison guard failures in The Shawshank Redemption. At least that's what you wrote in a blog entry on your website. I've never really had safety training through an Academy Award-nominated movie, so tell us a little bit how you came up with this idea.
Well, I think many of us have seen The Shawshank Redemption, where the main character spent the better part of his career stealthily digging in the back of his cell, eventually finding a route out of the prison, while at the same time fooling guards and becoming a model citizen. What got me to think about this in greater detail and apply it to safety was the incident in 2015 where we had some drama up in upper state New York. Two prisoners had escaped from the Clinton Correctional Facility up there and were on the loose and dangerous. And so reading some of the accounts of that in the press, it looked a lot like The Shawshank Redemption. You kind of wondered if those prisoners got their ideas from that movie.
Right. They had complacent guards and staff members in the prison that were compliant with them and helped them out.
Indeed. Mr. David Sweat was the main person that was escaping from the correctional facility in New York. And he took about 2 months to saw through the back of his cell. And you can imagine the kind of sound that made and other prisoners asking what was going on. And then he had an accomplice to help them beyond that point. So nightly, they were getting through the back of their cells and getting on the catwalk behind the cells, an open area in the inner workings of the prison, finding their way down to the basement, using heavy tools that were provided to them by either knowingly or unknowingly by prison staff, cutting through the major lead pipe and working their way out to at least temporary freedom. So there's a lot of things that we can learn in the safety world, asking ourselves, if hazards and risks are actively trying to, say, escape, find their way out and be realized to injure people, you know, what can we learn from an event like this up in upstate New York where prisoners seemingly had all the controls in the prisons to keep them incarcerated? We had people looking out for them. We had a major facility full of cement and barbed wire and things like that. Yet the determined prisoner was able to get out. Could we find the same parallel in the safety world?
Yeah, well, the prison in both the movie and in real life, it's a fortress, and all the obvious ways to escape are blocked. But you say that we do this with safety in the workplace.
Exactly, and in fact, no fortress is impenetrable. They were able to find their way out through pipes that serviced the prison. No safety program is impenetrable. And in fact, in both cases, it relies on the behavior of guards, the behavior of fellow prisoners, the behavior of prison staffs in our safety world, you know, and in order to keep injuries at bay, we may have the best practice engineering, controls, guards, and the like, but we still rely on human behavior, the human behavior of our safety professionals, of management and supervisors, foremen, and the folks doing the tasks that are coming in contact with these hazards. So the parallel is there.
So in the movie, prison guards were supposed to do nightly bed checks, but they didn't do them for days, weeks, months, because they figured the prison was so protected, the prisoners would never get very far anyway. So this, the laziness, complacency, and all of this is similar to safety in the workplace.
Imagine yourself being a guard in this facility. It is a fortress. You do these evening walks when you start your career. You keep walking around. It's a boring task. Everybody's sleeping. You see the same thing night after night, same thing night after night, same thing night after night. You even are responsible to walk these catwalks, which are probably pretty dingy, a little scary, damp, maybe even hard to get to. And the same thing, you walk these catwalks, and it's always the same. It's uncomfortable. And over time, your behavior extinguishes. You don't come into contact with any type of risk that the prisoners may escape. And over time, you don't see the benefit in doing these night strolls. In fact, one of the jokes was some prisoners saying the only thing that walks in the cell block so in the overnight shift are the cockroaches. So if you think about the same metaphor applied to safety, you can see how people who are responsible to do inspections of workplaces, looking for hazards, looking to make sure that the machinery and the processes are done in a way that's controlled to reduce the risk of injury or even some process safety issues like explosions. And it's a well-engineered system like many modern industries are, and you continue to look and you look and you look, and time after time you see nothing. Over time, the fidelity of those inspections decrease to the point, probably not so much as to completely not doing the task like the prisoners were doing, but we have plenty of experience out there in the safety world where safety processes are believed to be being done with fidelity, but they're not. Sometimes processes are skipped, or even in the case of very well-documented instances of pencil whipping. You know, that's where you have a form, and you are supposed to use the form kind of as a checklist to inspect or to observe other people's behavior, but you don't even go out and physically look at what you're supposed to, and you're checking the box so quick, it looks like you're whipping the pencil.
Right.
Similar to the prison guard.
Well, I know that safety managers, maybe in their own minds, they're saying, well, we do these meetings, these observations, and all the workers have their PPE, so dropping one of them won't hurt.
Well, you can see the multi-layered is a good point. The prison has many different layers, concrete, steel, as well as processes. Not only the prisoner walks around, but they're each in their own cell. They have a very dictated day. What they have access to is very limited. And there are many systems within systems in prisons. And in the safety world, we have the same thing. The systems have been designed by researchers and have been tested in the field, and they work, and injuries are down because of it. Within that is the paradox. It's the threat. With our success, how much latent risks, complacent hazards are out there now that we have these levels of systems to protect ourselves against injury? Is that promoting a certain level of complacency?
Mm-hmm.
So where these systems are indeed effective in reducing injury, maybe we are not we're not doing them the same level of fidelity, and we start missing things. You know, we have a lot of examples out there in process safety world. We have the Deepwater Horizon blowing up in the Gulf and spilling oil. We have examples when we look at fatality incidents and other situations, all the way down to the kind of things that appears a near miss within a company's records, and you investigate it, and it should have been controlled, but something went awry. So just assuming that our safety systems are going to protect us may be a valid assumption because they've been designed very well, but they require the human behavior, the person doing the process, inspecting the equipment and the like, to assure the fidelity of it. And so what we're worried about is, are we allowing these safety systems to drift a little bit? And that becomes a problem.
To me, it sounds like you need to have the safety managers or all employees be in a motivational seminar once a month to say, hey, don't forget to do this, or is there some other way to do that?
Well, Actually, your discussion made me think about not even having to flush the toilet in the airports anymore. I mean, everything's automated so much. It's become a part of our life, and it works in a lot of cases. I don't think, and I would argue against thinking that an awareness session or a motivational session would do anything. We know that making ourselves aware of our responsibilities in the safety program and making ourselves aware of the potential hazards do have an impact, but it's short-lived. And you can even see the positive impact of awareness sessions only lasting the course of a week, and then the rest of the environmental situation is going to take over. You know, it's going to go right back to where it was. Mm-hmm. And in fact, repeated motivational sessions, one after another, will lessen their impact over time. So
you
the
bet.
Bump you get, the first one's going to be bigger than the second one, the third one.
Right.
And some companies require having safety meetings on a monthly or so basis. And if you talk to a lot of safety professionals, they think that the impact of those are dwindling because after time, even those messages lose their impact.
Sure.
So thinking about actually how to design your safety systems, I would say redesign your safety systems, because many of them are in a position to capture these latent hazards and possible complacent risks that are out there. First of all, we got to get our arms around making sure everybody is interacting with these safety systems with good fidelity, so we're not getting pencil whipping and those kind of things. And that goes into a question of seeing the benefits of your work. The guard that walks around time after time, not seeing their contribution to keeping the prisoners safe and in their cells and from escaping, their behavior will extinguish. And too often, you know, we're doing forms and inspections and other things, part of our safety processes. And because we're trying to avoid injuries, and this is a paradox, Dan, because we're trying to avoid injuries, and if we're successful, they don't happen, how can we experience that success when nothing happens?
Right.
It's different with production. You know, if we work to increase production, we see a number increase, right? If we work on our business, we see profits increase. If we work on safety, we see nothing happening. And so we have to change our systems to make sure that we are counting what does happen. We are counting the number of latent hazards that we found. We are counting the number of at-risk behaviors that we've identified.
Right.
We are then mitigating those through actions, and we're counting those. And so we are producing something instead of avoiding something, if that's clear. And therefore, if we're producing something and we can count that and we can recognize it, reinforce it, celebrate it, then the person who's doing the forms sees their contribution to success instead of their contribution to, well, nothing happening. And so the, you know, the first stage of redesigning your safety systems is kind of working on your measurement system and make it a platform for production, for higher quality of observations, identifying risk, and something that we can look at as something that we've achieved our goal and we can indeed celebrate. You know, past that, then we're asking ourselves, what do we look at?
Mm-hmm.
So if we got fidelity, you know, are we looking at the right things? So you think about the hazards out there. Many of them are obvious. You know, in the prison, I think they probably took care of all the obvious escape routes. You know,
right.
They put gates up, they put cement up, they put bars within bars to think through the obvious escape routes. But some of the hazards that are still out there, you know, some of the ones that tend to lead to explosions, that tend to lead to the larger safety issues, tend to be latent. You know, in the Deepwater Horizon, Transocean, whose rig it was that exploded, they had executives out that very day onto the platform celebrating 7 years without an injury. And
oh,
so,
no.
You know, personal safety is one thing. I think we're getting really good at the kind of things, the cuts, the scrapes, the pinch points, the housekeeping, where you stand kind of issues, the how you do your work kind of issues. We're getting pretty good at those. And the same thing with hazards. We're getting pretty good at looking at machinery with professional engineers' eyes and finding where the hazards are. What about those latent hazards? Some of them are simply hard to see. They haven't manifested themselves before, and they're deep within equipment, and we don't see it until something happens. But other hazards that are easy to see, but we've habituated to, Mm-hmm. They're rebuilding the replacement for the World Trade Center there in New York City.
Right.
So it reminded me of the skyscraper photographs of the 1930s where workers were out on girders without any fall protection just sitting there eating lunch.
Right. I know. I remember that.
We'd be squeezing the pole, right? And,
right.
But they're, in the face of hazards, have habituated to it. So you kind of ask yourself, how many hazards are sitting there that we could see, but we're professionals and we're working in this facility all the time, and it's right there in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we're no longer inspecting and getting fresh eyes on it, whether or not there's the fidelity of that. And then we look at the behavioral side. So you got, you know, I call hazard something that's kind of equipment or condition-based. You know, behaviors can put you at risk as well.
Right.
And when I'm in plants, I know that I'm at risk. I don't know where the hazards are. I don't know where my behavior can get me hurt. And so I might just be unaware of the risks that are being taken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those programs out there that are doing behavioral safety, where workers and managers are observing each other, giving each other feedback and tracking this data to identify risks. That's one of the biggest approaches to try to turn around folks that aren't aware of the risks they're taking, get a second set of eyes on you.
Right.
You're watching it. But even then, everybody can kind of habituate to the risks that are taking. But the story in the Shawshank Redemption and our New York cell tells us that folks can get together to hide what risks are being taken.
Mm-hmm.
And people that are there to maybe enforce rules or to train you, maybe even complicit in teaching folks how to hide these risks being taken, or maybe even complicit in getting them to take the risks if there's production pressures and other things going on. So when we're looking to try to reverse the trend of complacency, you know, we got to ask ourselves, what are we looking at, and do we have a chance to look at these with a certain amount of fidelity?
Hey, this is Tim breaking into this podcast to tell you about my book, Dysfunctional Practices That Kill Your Safety Culture. A manager finds himself on top of a stepladder. A woman removes a guard to her machine. A worker is not wearing her safety glasses in the plant. A rustabout uses a wrong size clamp instead of retrieving the right tool. A supervisor teaches a new worker to take a shortcut. A mechanic climbs on top of the active machine to find the oil leak. Why do these folks do these things? Is it because they're stupid? We'll find out. Read or listen to the first chapter on safetydoc.com. Dysfunctional Practices, available now on Amazon and Lulu.com. And now, back to our podcast.
Each isn't going to help out. Is there a system that you can implement that makes you go, okay, let's look for latent hazards. Let's make sure that the behavioral safety checklists are current. What do you suggest?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up this question because, you know, from a behavioral standpoint, we recognize that most of behavior is due to the systems that we set up. Very little of the reasons why, the causes of behaviors, can be kind of attributed to the person. So we basically approach situations like this, like W. Edwards Deming did,
mm-hmm.
when being a management guru of the 80s, assuming that everybody's a willing worker. And so if we get away from assigning blame and thinking people may be stupid, because, you know, you can't fix stupid. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to coach the person, you're going to train them, and they're going to go back, and if we haven't changed the system, and we're going to end up in the same situation. And, you know, what are we going to do? If we keep running into this person, we fire them. And when we hire somebody, they're in the same situation and they're going to be doing the same thing. So,
yes,
we can do something. We can change the system and we can change in ways that are sensitive to these latent hazards and complacent risks that I was talking about. I think a first step, going back to this idea of the person side of behavior, is when we do have incidents. And I have many of these over the course of my career that I can give you examples of. One that comes to mind is in a fracking site where the coupling of a hose exploded because when a supervisor was decoupling the hose, he was supposed to go through about a 5 to 10 second check to see if there's any pressure still there after they shut down the pumps. And out of 10,000 times, probably only one time there's pressure. But in this one time, there was pressure there, and it exploded, and luckily it went through the back of a cab, and nobody's hurt.
Mm-hmm.
3 years later, he was teaching a green hat, you know, somebody who had never done the task before, how to do it, and was actually teaching them to take that shortcut, not do that check.
Oh, no.
Unfortunately, in that case, the casing exploded one time out of 10,000. But this time it ricocheted and injured the young man, gave him brain damage. And I was asked, why can't we blame that person? It has to be a person thing, and we really need to only have the right people that are going to be doing these tasks. And I asked the question, well, what happened the first time after we got done? Did you have an investigation? And they said, yes. And I said, what was the root cause? And they said, well, it was human error. He knew better.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, well, if it's human error, what did you do after that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the answer was nothing. We didn't change the situation. We didn't change the setting. We didn't change the environment. And therefore, how many other people were doing it the same way? How many other people across how many years? And did we set this person up to continue teaching it like he did? Because we just blamed the person. So if we kind of get past that we don't look at incidents as a chance to blame the person, and it gives us a chance to understand some of the latent stuff that was behind it, that's a good first step.
Right. Well, in the movie, they had this blaming the person, the punishment, where the prison guards wailed on prisoners to find out what they knew. And safety managers, of course, wouldn't beat down an employee, but punishing a worker can have kind of the same effect, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, in the upstate prison, there was reports coming out about a month after the event that guards were abusing the prisoners,
wow.
Trying to get that information out and for whatever other reason. And so, you know, what are you doing when you're punishing folks for taking risks? Well, punishment works. Risk taking goes down. But if the situation is set up to encourage those risks, then what you're doing is not necessarily getting rid of the risk. You're just increasing the incidence of hiding the risk.
Mm.
And so we see that in many, many occasions when we do root cause analysis and the person was indeed complicit in taking the risk. And he's probably been doing it for quite a long time, but all the paperwork showed that they were doing fine. And when you find yourself in that situation, you're asking yourself, well, if we use discipline as our going in position, as our major cell block, the major way we manage safety, you kind of wonder if you're actually creating a safer workplace or a workplace where people get really good at hiding the risks they're taking. And, you know, people that get really good at hiding the risks they're taking are probably also not telling you the hazards that are around and teaming up with you to find a way to do work processes safer and teaming up and identifying the hazards and conditions that are out there that need to be mitigated. And what you're doing is getting people to shut up.
It's sweeping it under the rug.
Sweeping it under the rug, yeah. One way to avoid discipline is just not to poke your head up. And unfortunately, what happened at the prison is you had this swept under the rug, and so you end up with the folks with determination finding their way out. And that's the same thing with injuries. If we're assuming that all the processes are going well, and, you know, I've heard people say that, I ask, why would somebody do the work process in this way? It's a safer way. It's also more cumbersome. It takes longer, and it's kind of silly looking, and it's hot and whatnot. Why would they do it? And the folks said, well, it's the rules. You have to do it because it's the rules. Well, you have the rules, and that's true, and you have discipline because of the rules, but you can also avoid discipline by doing some other stuff, like hiding the risk you're taking.
Right.
And typically, hiding is not just a one-person enterprise. It's a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the more discipline you put in place, the more you build this culture of hiding, if you would. And so that's why I think the behavioral-based safety systems that are put in place are a way of combating that. You know, and if they're done well, and believe me, I've seen plenty that weren't implemented well, but if they're done well, they have a basic premise of no name, no blame.
Mm-hmm.
Let us, we're asking you to help us find these latent hazards and risks. If you're doing it and you discover it, let us know. There's not going to be retribution. It's a learning opportunity. And so in these BBS systems with no name, no blame, you end up with an opportunity for a peer, a fresh set of eyes to watch, identify the risks that either knowingly or unknowingly being taken,
mm-hmm.
right? And then talk about them.
Right.
And then we trim them and we find risks that we otherwise wouldn't have known about in a way that they're not being hid, in a culture that is a reporting culture that's willing to try to find these risks and do something about it, because these employees have the most to gain. But what we don't do is, and unfortunately a lot of BBS programs do this, is once they find the risk, they have an awareness session. And they go, don't do this anymore. And everyone goes, no, I won't do this anymore. And guess what? And it's still being done. The next step is to do the analysis, to understand how that system's let them down, you know, what the work process, what the scheduling and planning, what the expectation, what the availability and the quality of tools, and, you know, there's a whole list of things that led that person to be in a position to take the risk. And if it's approached in that way, then you're going to get a lot more people reporting, because then reporting ends up changing the system in ways that are positive, in ways that reduce the risks that need to be taken. But unfortunately, in a lot of BBS programs, like I said with Transocean, they tend to be static, and you get a good bump for a couple of years, and people get excited about it, and you really knock out a lot of the things that are obvious, right?
Right.
But then after a couple of years, it plateaus, and BBS programs struggle because they're not getting added benefit beyond these kind of obvious things that are being seen. And so, you know, what I coach my clients to do is to consider a more dynamic BBS system where the behaviors aren't just some general, but you're targeting to maybe specific tasks or specific risk areas. And they're always changing, requiring employees to come up with new possible areas of risk that they are concerned about, and continuing to raise the bar to find the more and more latent risks. At the same time, resist over-engineering and to realize that human behavior is a part of the process, using the employees to help us identify where those latent risks are. I guess something we can't really do in prisons, because then we're asking people to be rats on each other, aren't we? Against the prison culture. And so you can see how cultural is a big part of it. If identifying risk is perceived as, hey, I'm ratting out my fellow worker, then you're not going to get anywhere. And that's where that no name, no blame piece comes in. And it takes time, and it takes successes and small wins, as your interview with Dr. Geller talked about, to work on that culture to a point where they see identifying risk as a way to help your fellow worker in an actively caring way, as opposed to ratting out your fellow worker. And once that thing turns, then we can use that mechanism of behavioral safety to now raise the bar and try to identify these latent hazards and risks that are behind the scene that a lot of employees may know about, or if they don't know about it, they're in the best position to find it out before someone gets hurt.
Well, unlike a prison, it's okay if you're at a fracking site or in a warehouse that you bring things up, because you're not going to get a shiv in your back from your coworker like you would in prison.
Well, coworkers have their own shivs. You know, there's the biggest, I'll tell you, the biggest commodity, the most valuable thing on a work site for a worker is their reputation.
Sure.
You know, they're a professional. They put in a honest day's labor for an honest day's pay. They know what they're doing. They demand and earned the respect of their fellow workers and managers. And if that reputation is somehow soiled, there's hell to pay.
Sure.
You have different social influences that can kick somebody out of the group, or even worse, you know. And so when you're devising this system, that's why you have to have the employees involved. You have to respect their knowledge of the task. You have to respect their visibility with where they're at and what's working. And in that respect, you are in a position then to use their knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And as we mine employees' knowledge and wisdom and are successful at changing the workplace to have safer processes and the like, then you're going to get more out of them. They're going to see that their input is useful, and they're going to provide more and more input. See, these hazard risks and talents, they're a moving target.
Mm-hmm.
The things that are going to try to get someone hurt, that's a moving target. It's not static either. What got you hurt 10 years ago is not going to get you hurt now. The new millennials coming in the workforce. We had a number of companies that had an aging workforce. You know, I've been working next to Fred for 15 years now, and now here's Joey. He doesn't know the tale, so now we have new things that can get you hurt. So it's a moving target. We have to have our systems as a moving target as well, to be able to be sensitive enough to pick up on not only latent hazards and risks, but the way that workplace changes create new hazards and risks. And I tell you, the people who know that are the folks on the ground.
Right. Well, I know we're close to the end of your time with us here today, and I want to make sure that I talk about, besides you being a professor at Appalachian State, you also do speaking engagements and consulting. Is your website safety-doc.com the best way to reach you?
It is, yeah. I have a number of years, we did some of the foundational research in behavioral safety, you know, way back in the 80s and refined it in the 90s. Have been researching that my entire career. I think many of us experience when you have a lot of stories in your head, you keep thinking about it, and the only way to get them out is to write them down, and then you can finally lay them to rest. And so a number of years ago, I started a blog on safety-doc.com, and it's just a bunch of free stories. It's free content. The rules are you can take them and steal them, use them for your safety talks and the like, pretend it's yours. I'm fine with that. But in return, you have to tell me your story so we can build a community of storytellers that really speak some truth kind of topics and safety that we really need to do.
This podcast is a production of safetydoc.com and is copyrighted by Timothy Ludwig, PhD. All rights reserved. For those small doses of inspiration, visit safetydoc.com. If you would like Dr. Ludwig to speak at your corporate or society safety function, simply use the contact link on safetydoc.com. Thanks for listening.